Good evening, everyone. I'm Will Fenton, Director of Research and Public Programs at the Library Company of Philadelphia. We are an independent research library founded by Benjamin Franklin. And since then, we have grown in all sorts of unexpected ways, and we have terrific program area strengths in African-American history, women's history, early Americana, and of course, graphic arts, which is really sort of the germination of today's special fireside chat. As I said, this is a different kind of fireside chat. Normally, it's just me and one other person who stuck with me. Today, you'll see I've got all sorts of friendly faces here, and you won't actually have to hear from me very much longer. This is the second installment of our special two-part series, Art and Spectacle in the 19th Century United States. And this is very much a partnership, but to describe that partnership, I'd like to turn it over to our MC this evening. Erica Piola is our curator of graphic arts and, importantly, the director of the Visual Culture Program.
No worries.
Pass it over to you, Erica.
Thank you, Will. And I say it was a very self-deprecating opening for you. So again, thank you. And I just want to welcome everyone to tonight's chat. And I hope everyone is having a good evening so far and will continue to have a good evening. As Will said, I'm Erica Piola. I'm the director of the Visual Culture Program, as well as the curator of graphic arts at the Library Company. And I'm hoping that many of you are return attendees from last week's engaging program. But if not, I wanted to just briefly recap the collaborative efforts behind tonight's chat, Art and Spectacle. Art and Spectacle is a showcase for art and art history students' insights from working with objects of visual culture from the library's holdings. It is a result of the partnership between the Visual Culture Program and Dr. Aaron Powell's fall semester class exploring spectacle and the historical construction of vision. Class session topics included the influence of innovations of technology, politics of class, race, and gender, and the intersection of visual material culture and art reception, and will be touched upon in tonight's presentations. The collaboration rooted in virtual class presentations, examining thematically relevant vernacular and popular artworks, reference and feedback sessions, and primary and secondary sources provided via email, epitomizes VCP's mission to promote visual literacy and the creative use of historical visual materials for the study of the past. And my work with the class this fall was a true highlight of this very challenging year. It is now again my pleasure to introduce Dr. Aaron Powell, Assistant Professor of American Art at Temple University, who will conclude tonight's opening remarks and make introductions for tonight's student speakers. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Erica. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to keep my remarks tonight very brief in order to save time for our four presenters and their work. But I did want to take the opportunity as we begin here to reiterate my thanks to you, Erica, and also to the Library Company for sharing the treasures of the graphic arts collection with us this fall. It's really been a pleasure for me to teach and to problem solve alongside of you. And I know that all of us in the Art and Spectacle Seminar at Temple University's Tyler School of Art and Architecture feel very pleased to be taking part in the visual, in the public programming tonight and celebrating the Visual Culture Program with our talks. So with that, I'm going to get straight to the main event. Our final four graduate student presenters this week are a really talented group of emerging scholars and artists. And they're each going to be sharing the results of their research into individual objects that they chose from the Library Company's collection. So they've done kind of deep dives in material culture, but from a distance. And I'd really like to thank them too for their resilience and hard work in the face of what's been a challenging semester, but one that's had real opportunities to kind of grow and expand our research possibilities at the same time. And to thank them too for sharing their hard work with us tonight. So with that, I'm going to introduce our first presenter this evening. And each of the grad student presenters is going to speak, and then I will return and introduce the next one, and we'll save all the questions for the end. But our first presenter this evening is Lauren McArdle. Lauren is a PhD student in art history at the Tyler School of Art and Architecture, and she also works as the school's director of development. Her research focuses on art, craft, and women's labor in the 19th century. And tonight she's going to be sharing her analysis of the Amy Matilda Cassie Friendship Album.
Thank you so much, Erin, and thank you, Erica and Will as well. It's been really quite incredible to be able to work in collaboration with the Library Company this semester, and I'm going to go ahead and start sharing my screen now. So you should all be able to see what I'm looking at now. Thank you so much for coming to listen tonight. We're all looking forward to sharing what we've spent the semester studying with you. Each of us has chosen a single object from the library company's collection to focus on and sort of do a deep dive on this semester. And so at the beginning of the semester, when we found out about that, I will say that I was a little overwhelmed, looking through the library collection, library company's collection, and thinking about how to identify an object that resonates with me and my own research interests. It seemed like almost an impossible task at first, but with Erin and Erica's help, I was lucky enough to identify the friendship album of Amy Matilda Cassie as the object that I wanted to really focus on this semester. And that's what I'll be talking about with you tonight. Amy Cassie was a well-known member of Philadelphia's African-American elite in the mid-19th century, and you can still visit the Cassie family home here in Philadelphia today, which is what we're looking at on the screen here. Her friendship album circulated among free Black people and abolitionists from 1833 to 1856 between Boston and Baltimore. The album is a rich source of information on how objects that were largely perceived and maintained as private could have public lives as well. I feel lucky to have been able to spend time with its pages, not only because of the fascinating network of relationships they testify to, but also because the album has inspired me to think much more broadly about creative opportunities for 19th century women, which is my own area of interest. I'm delighted to be able to share a little of what I've learned with you this evening. So let's start at the beginning. What were friendship albums? What was their purpose, and what can we learn from them about the ways in which women communicated privately within their own circles and more broadly? Emerging around 1825, albums were similar to scrapbooks in a lot of ways, created for socially conscious middle-class women and sometimes men, as a way to collect sentimental poems, prose, drawings, watercolors, and other various contributions from people in their social networks. Albums were particularly popular in New England and the Mid-Atlantic region. Although friendship albums were mass-produced by manufacturers, they attempted to mimic handcraft and were expensive, typically ranging in price from around $2 to $5, which today would work out to be between $50 and $140. Because they signified both literacy and middle-class appetites for sentimentality, most antebellum African Americans were excluded from taking part in the pastime of maintaining albums. But as we'll see today, some Black women did own albums, and as in the case of Amy Cassie, may have used them as more than just a representation of wealth and prestige. Entries could include things like floral illustrations and poems about womanhood, motherhood, and the home, among other domestic topics. Friendship albums were also frequently used as teaching tools to administer lessons in penmanship or literature to young women. In future research, I look forward to comparing them to other pedagogical tools like needlework, where I anticipate some interesting overlaps may be found. There are two examples of such pedagogical albums in the Library Company of Philadelphia's collections, belonging to sisters Mary Ann and Martina Dickerson, which we're looking at here on the screen right now. While the Dickerson sisters may have had less of a say than their tutors and who contributed to their albums, it's likely that for most women who maintained friendship albums, whether as educational tools or as a representation of their once popular enjoyment, this kind of writing showed their commitments to learning, respectability, and social uplift. Black friendship albums documented personal encounters. So a friend who lived locally might take an album home with her and then return it after making a contribution in its pages, and out-of-town friends would contribute while visiting. So as you can perhaps imagine, the arrangement relied more on social contact than on the postal system. So these albums wouldn't be put in the mail and sent to someone for contributions. The contributions to each pages would be made in person. So let's turn our discussion now to Amy Cassie and her album. Born Amy Matilda Williams in 1808, she grew up in New York City, the daughter of prominent New York minister Peter Williams, Jr. She attended the African Free School in New York and was involved in Black organizations and newspapers in her early teens. At the age of 17, she moved to Philadelphia, where she met and married the barber, businessman, and anti-slavery activist Joseph Cassie. She became a member of the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society and served in several other philanthropic organizations as well. Her friendship album is one of only a handful created by Black Philadelphians still in existence today, including those of the Dickerson sisters that we just looked at earlier. It's a wonderful representation of her commitment to literary culture, which inspired her initiation of the first mixed-gender reading society for Black Philadelphians, the Gilbert Lyceum. On the surface, Cassie's album looks fairly typical. Its ornately embossed Moroccan leather cover features florals and ovals with a lyre or harp positioned in the center, which you can just barely see in this image here. That's a typical design among Black women's friendship albums of the time. The gilding around the edges of the corner of the cover indicates that the book was valued and valuable, but the spine carries a single word, album, lending to the book's relative simplicity. If you look here, you'll see as a point of reference, Cassie's album side by side with that of the Reverend Aaron B. Burdick, a white man who lived from 1830 to 1911 in Grafton, New York. With its mother of pearl inlay, you can see how much more deluxe the Reverend's album is. Cassie's album measures about 11 by 9 inches. It's 75 pages filled with thick sheaves of paper in different colors, now faded blues, yellows, and pinks. The title page reads, Original and Selected Poetry, etc., Amy Matilda Cassie, inscribed in ornate calligraphy. A preface to the album follows a few pages later. I'll point out the last line. Now, reader, as you find delight in scanning o'er what others write, 'tis hoped in gratitude alone you'll add a tribute of your own, and thus, with one choice piece at least, enrich this mental picnic feast. Cassie began her album in 1833, the year the earliest entries were made, although the entries aren't arranged chronologically. Experiencing the album is a process involving more than just the reading of a text and appreciation of delicate watercolors and drawings. I was fortunate enough to work with the album in the library company's reading room, and as I gently thumbed through its pages, feeling their powdery texture and being careful not to turn too quickly, my memory scrambled to identify similar experiences I've had with objects imbued with memory, hope, belief, or sorrow. Touching Cassie's album and being touched by it in return makes me think of author Tina Camp's theory of multiple forms of contact. Through visual contact, seeing, physical contact, touching, psychic contact, feeling, and the sonic contact Camp refers to as listening to images or objects, we're allowed deeper access to the various impressions they might leave on us. On the surface of the album, it seems easily enough understood, easily enough known as the product of a woman's pastime. But let's consider whose hands held this volume, whose minds contributed to what we see, touch, feel, and hear when we read through its pages. Whether the entries be merry, sorrowful, or full of conviction, the album contains a multiplicity of emotions and aspirations from leaders among the abolitionist movement. The first entry we come to was crafted by African-American educator and anti-slavery activist Sarah Mapps Douglas, a colleague of Cassie's in the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society and a frequent contributor in the pages that follow. A token of love from me to thee, reads the inscription below a watercolor painting of a Black butterfly on a floral branch, contrasting so starkly against the white page that it seems to lift off of it. This artistry, as with many of the other floral watercolors in the album, probably took its inspiration from one of the many popular flower painting instruction manuals that helped provide proper training for girls of that time. The artwork and poetic effusions of the many women who contributed to the album, including Margaretta Fortin, whose work we see here, Mary Fortin, Sarah Fortin Purvis, Rebecca Buffum, Susan C. Wright, and Hannah L. Stickney, represent the proper education and cultivation of middle-class women in America. But that isn't what makes this album unique. All of the women who made entries in Cassie's album were known for publicly combating slavery, challenging racial prejudice through racial integration within their organizations, publishing anti-slavery pamphlets, and petitioning for abolition. Cassie's album isn't simply a collection of sentimental poetry, prose, and paintings. It's a who's who of leaders in the abolitionist movement in the Northeast. In fact, the entry following Sarah Douglas's Butterfly is an original sonnet by the prominent abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, who also contributed a three-page essay, The Abolitionist Cause, in 1833. Garrison visited the Cassies and other Black Philadelphian supporters on his way out of the country, possibly under threat of arrest, as he sought to make his way to England to raise money for the abolitionist cause. A frequent visitor to Philadelphia, Garrison often featured news and writings of the local Black women's literary societies, along with their anti-slavery activities, in his newspaper, The Liberator, for which Amy's husband, Joseph Cassie, was a local agent in Philadelphia. The sonnet, which tells the story of a lonely bird trapped by the fowler, Disappointment, may indeed signify Garrison's own flight from those seeking to stop him in his mission. The overlap between feminine sentiment and abolitionist fervor is perhaps most interestingly captured in the lines by Frederick Douglass, penned in 1850 on page 35 of the album. Douglass's entry is brief, but very serious. "I never feel more entirely out of my sphere," he writes, "than when presuming to write in an album." He compares the elegance and beauty of the album to a garden that he looks on from the uneven, stony ground he walks upon. "It is mine to grapple with huge wrongs, with gigantic tyranny," he writes, closing with the words, "This, my dear friend, is my apology for not writing something becoming the pages of your precious album." The heaviness of Douglass's words and the ardor of Garrison's essay on abolitionism starkly contrast with the seemingly lighthearted mood of most of the album's other entries. So much so, in fact, that it makes me wonder whether Amy Cassie thought of her album as more than just a compendium of writings from friends and colleagues she admired. Amy Cassie and the women in her circle studied drawing manuals, decorative floral works, instruction books, and women's periodicals, but all while they challenged slavery in public meetings, defied public opinion with their racially integrated organizations, and worked against slavery on many other platforms. Could we perhaps take an entry like this one about good wives? I hope you all take a moment to read this because it's really quite funny. "Good wives to snails should be akin, always their houses keep within." Could we perhaps interpret an entry like this by Mary Fortin, another member of the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society, as an inside joke among friends? I think it is possible that Amy Cassie may have intentionally leveraged a popular feminine pastime to create her own personal record of abolitionist activism, knowing that as an album, it would likely be kept and cherished for generations. Perhaps she saw her album as a kind of teaching tool after all. We may not be able to answer such questions definitively, but they certainly seem worth consideration. Perhaps Amy Cassie's album can act as a catalyst through which we might open our minds to possible interstitial histories. How can we respectfully probe its contents for alternate modes of considering what we think we know? I want to close with a couple of photos of another album I found in the Cassie family folder at Temple University's Bloxon collection, that of Amy Cassie's daughter, Sarah. Though the contents of Sarah's album appear more typical for that of a young girl, I wonder if perhaps Amy gifted it to Sarah in the hope that she too might find a way to make her voice and those of others heard. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren. That was wonderful. So our second presenter this evening is Allison Anderson. Allison is an award-winning artist and a second-year MFA student in the painting program at the Tyler School of Art and Architecture. Her project this semester has taken the form of a multimedia artistic response to a 19th century illustration of Maria Monk that was found here in the library company.
All right, so I am a painter, and because of COVID, I started to dabble in animation because we have to present everything online. So I'm going to give you a little artist statement and why I chose Maria Monk, and then I'll show you the video I made. "I am inspired by women who have blazed their own path, for good or bad. Women who have refused to shut up at the mercy of powerful men. I paint women who ultimately embrace being called a bitch. Women who define their own unique version of feminism. Women like Monica Lewinsky, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and Stormy Daniels. To color in their portraits is another way of painting myself as strong as them. Painting them as if I was transported back to the late 90s, coloring in my Lisa Frank Sea Animals book. Painting men like Bill Clinton and Harvey Weinstein is another way of identifying traits of predatory behavior. The prevalent use of hot pink represents me reclaiming my dark past by representing the current feminist movements like Me Too with this color. So when it came time to pick my final art history class at Tyler School of Art, it was a no-brainer to choose Aaron Powell's art and spectacle in the 19th century. Like every other American, even if they don't want to admit to it, I love celebrity culture. Growing up in the 90s, I witnessed the invention of continuous 24-hour news cycle channels. Having both sets of grandparents babysit me, CNN or Fox News was always on. I can remember vividly watching OJ drive his white Bronco down the 91 freeway into Orange County. I witnessed daily the news calling Monica Lewinsky a ditzy bimbo and Hillary Clinton a snake. Now we witness the same thing with President Trump's female accusers who try to tell their story of being threatened. Being a survivor of sexual abuse, I'm fascinated with women who have been in similar positions. For this particular project of finding an object to investigate in the Library Company in Philadelphia, I knew I wanted to investigate something of a scorned woman from the 19th century. My initial search started in portraits of American women, which led me down a rabbit hole of women who were considered criminals because they either had abortions or were cross-dressing as a man to help fight in the Civil War. I came across Maria Monk under Women Writers and Female Offenders. What struck me so much about her portrait was that it was a side profile clearly resembling a mugshot. Sure, there are other portraits in the Library Company's collection of women at side profile, but Maria's was striking because of how detailed and clearly identified her features were. It was as if this portrait was made to identify her on the street. Another signifier of this being a mugshot was underneath her profile, it said number 19, Maria Monk, as if this was the 19th century version of a placard with the offender's name, date of birth, weight, and booking ID. What really interested me, Maria, was the Library Company's description of her, and she was a supposed author of her book, Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk. That was about her time as a nun in a convent in Montreal where she was sexually abused. Naturally, this book rocked society, and everyone thought she was just a liar in order to sell books. Little is known on Maria Monk's early life, but it is believed she was born on June 1, 1816 in Quebec to a Protestant family. It is also rumored that during her childhood, she suffered a brain injury that gave way to behavioral problems such as promiscuity, but there is no significant real evidence of this claim that I tried to find. She had no mention of it in her book as well. Growing up, she also worked as a servant girl to help her family. In order to make a better life for herself, she decided to convert to Catholicism and become a nun at the Hôtel Dieu convent in Montreal, specifically for fallen women. She was told in order for her services as a nun, she would not only have a place to stay, but she could also learn French and arithmetic, which was something she was deeply passionate about. Sure, in the beginning of conversion, she heard rumors from other nuns having little devils biting at her ankles. But nothing could be as bad as what she experienced working as a sex worker on the streets. She would soon learn that her services would include having sexual intercourse with the priests. On top of that, when the nuns became pregnant, the priests would first bless the babies, then have the nuns strangle the babies to death, and finally make the nuns throw the babies down in a lime pit. If the nuns spoke against any of this, they would be practically beaten to death down in the cellars of the church. Maria became pregnant at the age of 18 by one of the priests and decided she would run away. On the run, she met Reverend William K. Hote, who was a head of an anti-Catholic group named the Canadian Benevolent Association. He brought her to New York City, where she wrote the book detailing every horrific incident she witnessed. Once the book was finally published in 1836, it sold way, giving way to the spectacle of Maria being named in the press constantly. No one believed her, as well as not having really written the book herself. Everyone called her a liar and a slut, just trying to make a dime. something us Americans are no stranger to, Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal. What made Maria's story such a spectacle was that this wasn't the first time Americans heard horrifying rumors about the Catholic Church. There was one church in Charleston, South Carolina in 1834 that had rumors as well. By 1839, Maria Monk made her way to Philadelphia, where she gave birth to a child, therefore losing all support from people who believed in her sexual abuse because the child was fatherless. Maria drifted out of public eye for the time being. Her name wouldn't be mentioned again until her death in 1849 in New York City, where she was living in a brothel. So I now present you Maria Monk's Awful Disclosures, A Nun's Life in a Convent Exposed. I used to think that of a nun to be the happiest of all women, and a convent as the most peaceful, holy, and delightful place to live. I could strengthen my French and learn arithmetic. The other nuns did warn me, however. They told us that we shall have many little devils biting at our ankles. The older nuns even told me that the head nuns took involvement in something evil. One night I was instructed to go down into the cellar for one of the most important chores of all. To my astonishment and horror, we soon learned that we had to live in practice of sexual intercourse with the priest. I was in their power and deeply felt this. We had to bless the babies, then strangle the babies to death. Then finally, we had to throw the babies in the bottom of the lime pit to rot. One of the nuns finally had enough of this. She said she'd rather die than kill another baby. So I thought long and hard, asking God what I should do. So I decided to speak up. I tried to get the hell away from there. So what's a girl to do to make a living? So I started to write about it. Of course I went to the doctor too and told him everything. He even encouraged me to write. Meanwhile, I started to enjoy myself. Of course they called me a liar. A slut, and a whore. But I wasn't gonna let that stop me.
Thank you, Allison. It's so exciting. I know animation has been kind of a stopgap measure for you during COVID, but I think it really brings an exciting life to your work. And certainly it's been fun to see where you've taken this illustration. So I'll now introduce our third presenter of the evening, Joanna Platt. Joanna is a second year master's student in art history at Tyler, and she also holds an MFA in sculpture from the University of the Arts. Her research this semester has centered on questions surrounding art and labor in the 19th century United States that have been raised by A Penny Dreadful Valentine, depicting a blacksmith. And it's a project that's been inspired in part by Joanna's personal expertise in blacksmithing and foundry work. So I'll pass it to you, Joanna.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Powles. Thank you, Erica and Will. And thank you to the Library Company for hosting us. And thank all of you for coming. The title of this piece is A Blacksmith, and it has been dated to between 1840 and 1880. It is a comic valentine, or penny dreadful as they were nicknamed, an inexpensive, often hand-colored woodblock print. The card's survival into present day is due to the historically minded collecting habits of John McAllister and his son, John Archibald McAllister. Few comic valentines exist in private collections, as they were often sent by the lower classes of society and tended to be destroyed by the recipient out of anger or shame. Most of the McAllister collection was never mailed and instead came directly from the printers and publishers. The text on this valentine reads, "Was ever such a dingy devil seen? A perfect antidote to love, I ween. Black as your forge, eyes like your furnace red. When you appear, folks start back with dread. The fire at your forge may continue to shine, but I will never wed such a black valentine." Looking at blacksmiths through contemporary eyes, we see exquisitely rendered wrought iron work, the incredible architectural details fabricated by Samuel Yellin and others. It seems strange that these men would be comedic characters, objects of derision. Why would someone who made such beautiful things be referred to as a dingy devil and cause folks to start back with dread? What does this valentine tell us about 19th century attitudes towards blacksmiths? In this talk, I aim to explain how this simple print manifests cultural attitudes towards work and labor in an era of great change. But my first question has to be, how is this a valentine? Before the mid-19th century, Valentine's Day was not commonly celebrated in the United States. However, the advent of Valentine's cards and the influence of London fashion popularized the holiday, which in its American infancy still retained the focus on coupling of the early modern iterations. The commercialization of Valentine's Day opened the holiday to the full spectrum of people, not just marriage-age couples, but children, older adults, singles, etc. By including the broad range of social relationships, stationers and print shops could make more sales and create a wider variety of sentiments. These comic valentines, often sent anonymously, derived from the bawdy traditions of carnival, and were seen by 19th century society as crass and lower class. Also, like this fireman, they were often sexually suggestive. The comic or vinegar valentines were broken down into categories of insult ranging from light mockery to total annihilation, as you can see in this awful dentist. These valentines derided the working classes in a wide range of professions, from doctors to bricklayers to washerwomen to firefighters and dentists. In creating broad categories of professional stereotypes, this comic valentine also reinforces the American idea of profession as identity. These satirical valentines mocked those who did not conform to societal norms and were used to define and establish social roles. They spoke to American ambiguities in class status, anxieties over social rank, and lampoon people trying to raise their social class through dress or affect. In the regulation of social norms, comic valentines often mock those of lower social status. As Annabella Pollen states, the sentiments were more like mob rule than righteous uprising. This regulation of societal norms was also carried out through the tabloids of the day, and the blacksmith seems to play a critical role in these 19th century morality tales. This further reinforces the sentiment depicted on our text, on our card. Religious tracts, which were small pamphlets written to educate the working classes, are filled with morality tales featuring blacksmiths. For example, in Sorrowful Sam, which is from the Cheap Repository for Moral and Religious Tracts, which is such a great name into itself, we read the tale of two blacksmiths, John Parker and Sam Waters. both blacksmiths spend their time at an alehouse called the Tennis Court, which, and I quote, causes more poverty in the parish than dearness of provisions or want of labor. John has a good wife, and through the guidance of a wealthy benefactor, learns the error of his ways, becoming a respectable man. However, Sam has an angry wife, and only discovers the error of his ways after passing out dead drunk in the road and being crushed by a carriage, resulting in the loss of his legs. While there is way too much to fully unpack in this one, it begins to establish the blacksmith as prone to overindulging in life's corporal pleasures. These concepts of blacksmith's immoral nature are reinforced through multiple tabloid mentions and poems circulated through the press, further establishing him as a comedic character. But why blacksmith? It would seem that the late 19th century blacksmith does not conform to contemporary romantic notions of the artistic genius creating masterful works in his forge. Most blacksmiths engaged in some manufacturing, but they were more akin to repairmen or jack of all trades, with most of their business coming from rote tasks such as horseshoeing or repairing carriage wheels rather than decorative ironwork. The 19th century was also an era of rapid industrialization in the United States. The century began with much of the economic production happening in artisanal workshops, but factories were the primary source of manufactured goods by the end of the century. The blacksmith of the mid-19th century was struggling to find his place in the shifting economic climate. By the end of the century, the profession was in decline. The blacksmith had lost his status and become a character to be scorned. This comic Valentine was made for the amusement of the working classes, yet ridiculed their toils. The blacksmith in our Vinegar Valentine is depicted as hard at work. His hair is disheveled, his brow furrowed in concentration, while he is properly aproned, and the arm that would be over the fire is protectively sleeved, as you can see right here. The hammer's position in the hand is not correct for the operation he's performing. You can see that also right there. A hammer would be held closer to the end of the handle to gain more leverage, thus achieving more power with one blow. The inaccuracies in the representation seem to reiterate the sentiments of the text, showing that technical literacy or a basic understanding of blacksmith's processes is not valued by the culture that produced this image. Manual labor has been derided throughout history, from the Greeks through the Renaissance and into today. However, the 19th century provided a unique confluence in the intersection of chattel slavery, industrialization, and the newly emergent philosophies centered on labor reform. Industrial capitalism reinforced these historical power structures, creating a hierarchy of drudge work performed by the lowest classes, the most impoverished, immigrants, and African Americans. In the 19th century, class identity was created through the types of work performed, not through wealth or social status. The dirtiest, most dangerous, and awful forms of manual labor were borne by the most vulnerable and least educated members of society. There was a substantial social distinction between those who worked with their hands and those who performed intellectual tasks, even though a clerk and a landowning blacksmith earned similar wages. While the artisanal side of the blacksmith process could be seen as an activity of the mind, most repairmen blacksmiths were still viewed to be lower class. This separation between labor of the mind and the body is especially true for black workers. According to Nicholas Brommel, racism consigned the freed black to an identity determined by bodily characteristics. Their skin color tied them to a specific identity as workers, whether they were free or enslaved. Through the phrases, black is your forge, and black Valentine, the text of our card derides the blacksmith's appearance in a way that could speak to racist attitudes of the day. The Civil War fundamentally changed the economic and social order, with debates ranging about the nature of free labor. Many blacksmiths were African American, and there was great competition for work between black and white workers and new immigrants, creating class conflict even amongst laborers. These complexities of labor relations did not just end there, as the 19th century also saw an emerging consciousness of labor exploitation. The economic crisis created by the Civil War radicalized the working class, who were steeped in abolitionist ideas of free labor. Even in these movements, the metaphor of the forge was too great to resist, as the lyrics of the blacksmith's anvil can attest. In the Hollywood version of this talk, we would pan back to reveal a piano, and I would sing this to you, but I'm just going to read it instead. Strike, strike, the worker's anvil, for the cause of labor. Strike for your homes and freedom, for each friend and neighbor, everyone for this great cause and reform laws, now demand complete protection. Strike, strike, the fire is glowing. Heed ye not the minions seeking to capture labor and clip the pinions of our clan. Our blacksmith exists amidst this multifaceted reconstruction of labor and the shifting climate of the Industrial Revolution. Even these throwaway pieces of material culture contain a multifarious historical narrative, providing a scrap of insight into the cultural attitudes that produced it. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. That was wonderful. Our final presenter in the program this evening is Vincent Forsell. Vince is a PhD student in art history at the Tyler School of Art and Architecture. His research explores LGBTQ art histories, particularly in the art and activism of the 1980s AIDS crisis. His work tonight describes a sculptural medal that depicts Walt Whitman as when was once in the collection of the Franklin Inn Club. So I'll pass it over to you, Vince.
Thanks, Dr. Pals. And thank you to Will and Erica, too, for putting this together. And thank you all for being here. It's so nice to be able to present the research that me and my colleagues have done on our work. So I'd like to open my presentation with a quote from the New York Times from November 16, 1919. Quote, the Franklin Inn Club of Philadelphia is preparing, in celebration of Walt Whitman's centenary year, a bronze medal of the poet, and will have it ready in early December. It is the work of R. Tate McKenzie and may be obtained at a price of $7.50, end quote. When I first began researching R. Tate McKenzie's medal depicting Walt Whitman, this small article from the New York Times was the only piece of information in the Library Company in Philadelphia's research file on this work. Considering the medal's physical properties, we know that the medal was cast in bronze, as the article stated, and measures about 5 inches in diameter by 3 millimeters in thickness. On the medal's front, a relief likeness of well-known author Walt Whitman is featured, a depiction likely based off of the popular 1887 photographic portrait of Whitman taken by George Cox when the poet was 68 years old. By comparing both the age and pose of the Whitman figure featured on the medal to the one in Cox's photograph, it appears as though both figures look toward the viewer behind wrinkled eyes that have a tired, yet friendly and welcoming nature about them that is difficult to put into words. To the left of Whitman's likeness on the medal, a facsimile of the artist's signature lines the work's outer rim, with the years 1819 to 1919, edged at the bottom to signify this medal's commemoration of the 100th anniversary of Whitman's birth. To the right of Whitman's likeness, the creator R. Tate McKenzie's initials are etched into the surface of the medal, with the words, Fascite, or created, for the Franklin Inn Club, etched beneath it, signifying both the artist and patron of the work itself. In considering this medal, I formulated several questions that I hope to answer in my research. I first found myself asking, what is the Franklin Inn Club? The medal makes clear that the Franklin Inn Club, which is a private gentleman's club founded in Philadelphia in 1902 by a group of prominent authors to, quote, promote social intercourse and friendship among authors, illustrators, editors, and publishers, end quote, were the patrons of this work. The article alludes to the fact that these medals were created in bulk to be sold by the club for the purposes of fundraising, not mass-produced, but not created to be unique or standalone either. The only other copies of this medal that I could find are 2 pieces currently for sale on eBay, perhaps indicating that they did not sell particularly well. Looking closer at the Franklin Inn Club itself, we come to understand just how exclusive this club was meant to be. In its founding bylaws, the club's founders decided that the club would be limited to 100 members, and that any prospective men seeking admission to the club must have, quote, authorship of one or more copyrighted books, articles, stories, poems, essays, plays, or pictorial illustrations, end quote. A membership fee of $20, equivalent to nearly $600 today, was required to be paid annually, with non-payment resulting in expulsion from the club. The club was exclusive to men only and became the first private gentlemen's club to open its membership to women in 1978. Next, I found myself asking, who is Art Tate McKenzie? Somewhat of a Renaissance man, McKenzie was a well-known physician, sculptor, writer, educator, athlete, and soldier who gained entrance to the Franklin Inn Club in 1904. Artistically, he was well-known for his bronze sculptures of athletes, which many critics lauded for the impeccable attention he paid to the anatomical detail of human musculature. Considering this medal specifically, it must be said that this work was not the first work to be created by McKenzie or the Franklin Inn Club. In 1905, it was reported in the literary periodical The Bookman that McKenzie surprised the club during a formal dinner with a commemorative bronze plaque bearing a relief-style portrait of Charles Brockden Brown, an author widely regarded as America's first well-known novelist. Unlike the Whitman Medal, which must have been created in some sort of series to allow for them to be sold by the club, the Brown plaque was one of a kind and created to adorn the walls of the club as a memorial to this forefather of American literature. With this in mind, we understand that the creation of such commemorative objects for the Franklin Inn Club was not unique to the Whitman Medal alone. I next found myself questioning why McKenzie chose to create a medal celebrating Walt Whitman's centenary year for the Franklin Inn Club. The article from the New York Times states that, quote, any surplus funds after defraying the cost of the medal will be applied to the erection of a permanent Whitman memorial by the club, end quote. However, I could find no such memorial, either in Philadelphia or elsewhere, that was funded by or linked to the Franklin Inn Club in any way. Perhaps indicative of poor sales, as I mentioned earlier, regarding the scarcity of examples of this work. The most obvious reason I could theorize that the Franklin Inn Club might want to commission this medal and erect a memorial for the late poet was the fact that during this time in American history, Whitman was perhaps the most famous author in the country. Coupling this elevated status with the fact that he was active in the Philadelphia area, living just outside of the city in the suburb of Camden, New Jersey, it makes sense that the Philadelphia-based Franklin Inn Club, a literary institution, would want to pay their respects to such an iconic figure. However, the question I seek to answer in my terminal paper on this work is whether or not the Franklin Inn Club were taking advantage of Whitman's celebrity status to raise funds for a memorial in his honor and in turn bolster their own status among Philadelphia's gentlemen's clubs. In this way, for the Franklin Inn Club, I believe these medals functioned as a means to an end rather than unique works of art in themselves. The last question I had about this medal that I wish to discuss here was how it got into the collection of the Library Company of Philadelphia. According to their website, the medal was gifted to them by the prominent Shakespearean scholar, Dr. Horace Howard Furness. And although it does not say this outright, it might be assumed that it was gifted by the equally prominent Dr. Horace Howard Furness Jr., as his father, perhaps the more well-known Dr. Horace Howard Furness Sr., passed away in 1912, 7 years before the medal's creation. Making this even more confusing is the fact that both Furness Sr. and Jr. were members of the Franklin Inn Club. The elder Furness joined the Franklin Inn Club during its inaugural year in 1902 and remained an active and prominent member of the club until his death in 1912. His connection with the Library Company in Philadelphia dates even earlier, with their archives showing that he purchased stock in the Library Company in 1889. The younger Furness was also a member of the Franklin Inn Club, gaining membership in 1909. However, unless he inherited his father's shares in the Library Company, I could find no connection between them and the younger Furness. And it is this lack of connection that makes this object's donation to the Library Company somewhat perplexing. The lack of evidence or study around this work makes it seem as though the work resists research itself. Quote, I exist as I am, that is enough, end quote, is a line from Walt Whitman's poet, A Song of Myself. And throughout the conduction of my research, it seemed as though the object was speaking these words to me. It is an object that exists between mass production and unique creation, yet only a few pieces are recorded to exist. It is an object that finds itself resting at the library company, yet we do not know exactly how it got there. What is certain, however, is that R. Tate McKenzie's Walt Whitman Medal is a compelling yet mysterious object that provides insight into the history of the American literati, exclusive gentlemen's clubs, and artisanal craftsmanship. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Vince. That was terrific. So now we can ask everybody to come back and join us, and we'll offer questions and answers. I thought I'd kick things off. Erica's going to moderate our questions for us, but I wanted to start with one that I'll address to the whole group. And this one, I really just wanted you all to reflect on the process of doing this research into material culture from a remote perspective over the course of the semester. I think, Lauren, you had a chance to come into the library company, but I'm not sure that anyone else actually got to see their objects in person, even though they were sort of the centerpieces of your work. So I was just wondering if you could talk about, did this present any unexpected challenges or perhaps benefits in doing your work from a distance? And, you know, maybe if you could say too a little bit about why you chose the object that you did. Anybody can kick things off.
Well, I also had the opportunity to get to the library company and see my object in person, although it was bigger than I expected. I was kind of assuming that because my object was flat, I wasn't going to need to be there, but I was kind of shocked at the scale. So I think also it's a testament to how great the web collection of the library company is, that so much of the information was there. Although Erica was very sweet and pulled a fantastic folder full of supplemental information, which I was able to pick through and learned a lot about the history of the object and also about the other researchers who had drawn on the same object, which I thought was fascinating.
I would just add to that to say that the digitization of the friendship album that I looked at was incredible. I believe, Erica, if I'm correct, it was the product of another project, perhaps grant-funded project. I'm not sure I'm remembering that correctly, but that whole album is really wonderfully digitized on the library company's website, and you can go through and look at every page in high resolution. But I will say that when you're studying an object that you can hold in your hands, there's really something about having that physical object, touching that physical object and sort of feeling, I don't know if this makes sense, but feeling the history that it contains, sort of feeling connected physically. I talked about this a little bit in my talk to the information that it contains and the other people who have had it, who have touched it through their lives. So I will say that I feel very lucky to have been able to study with that object in person, but had we not had that opportunity, which we almost didn't, the wonderful digitization that the library company offers for that album was super duper helpful.
Yeah, so I'll just jump in quickly because I know it's like 7:59 and so our time is running short, but I don't want to cut off Vince or Allison if you wanted to respond to Aaron's question. Good.
Do you have anything to share? Otherwise I know we've got a couple here from the public that we can pass along.
Yes, we have a couple questions, or I should say a question and saying wonderful presentations, which I will completely agree with. I just want to, again, thank you all for the wonderful work that you've done this semester and how much I enjoyed working with you. And I found I'm so engaged by what you were saying and as well as with the previous session. But actually one of the questions, it's specific to Joanna, but potentially others might want to jump in. But it's asking, the 19th century had all kinds of courting conventions. Do you know whether the blacksmith Valentine was intended for unwanted suitors? I certainly would not be pleased to receive it.
Yeah, I think it depended on the degree, I think. A lot of them were sent anonymously, so it was certainly meant in that regard to be mean. But there were some that were sort of meant in like a more carnivalesque convention where it was just kind of like bawdy and jokey and just kind of like flirtatious in that kind of like, I don't know, I keep thinking like when the kids punch each other on the playground kind of sentiment to show that they like you, which is awful in itself, but we'll not go there. So I think it kind of depends on which Valentine you were sending and how you were sending it.
So it's 8 o'clock, so we can finish, right on the dot there. I just want to thank Erin and all the presenters tonight. Fantastic job, so informative. I feel like I need to be in touch with you so I can add your talks to the research files. So I'll be in touch. So especially, Vince, we've got more research for the Whitman file there. But I also just wanted to end by saying quickly that there's no fireside chat next week because of the holiday. But please join us again in 2 weeks, because it's a VCP has taken over the fireside chats once again in early December. And we're going to have our VCP 2019-2020 fellow Rebecca Santier speaking on Carbon Futures is the title of her talk, Cultivating Coal Consumption in the Second Quarter of the 19th Century. And it's going to examine coal's multiple roles culturally and geologically in the visual economy of the antebellum period. And I should also note it's at an earlier time. So it's going to be at 5 o'clock instead of 7 o'clock. So hopefully more of you can join us in 2 weeks. And I just want to wish, I know it's difficult times, but I hope everyone can have a happy holiday in some way next week. So again, thank you so much for joining us. I'm not sure if Will wants to pop in to also say a good night for the evening. I don't see him popping in, so I think we're probably good. So thank you again, everyone, for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Erica.